Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, where our job is to help you build visibility, professional credibility, and connection with your ideal client by putting the human at the center of innovative marketing, so you can build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship with your ideal clients. I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm honored that you're here with me. If you haven't joined our wonderful marketing transformation community yet, go to innovabiz.co and collect your free gift as well. Do subscribe to the show and also leave a review because it helps others find us. Let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast.
First of all, you can't allow anything to be too precious to you. You can't fall in love with your own stuff. You have to be ruthless when you edit. You get rid of everything that's not essential. You know, and the more you do that, the greater you refine that, the better the work that you do will be. And it's that kind of focus. So that's why I say that that's true not only in art, it's also, you know, true in business. That, you know, you've got to focus on what it is and be ruthless about it.
Welcome back. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. If you haven't yet listened to my recent conversations with Megan Lynch of Six Point Creative and with social media marketing specialist Neil Schaefer, then check them out after you've listened to today's conversation, of course. I'm really excited to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest today, B. Jeffrey Madov, the founder of Madov Productions. His company collaborates with ad agencies, with public relation firms, and directly with clients to produce commercials, corporate branding films, live streaming events, social media, and web content. Jeffrey's clients include Ralph Lauren, Victoria's Secret, Tiffany, Radio City, the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, Harvard University, and Weill Cornell Medical College. Very impressive list. He's also an adjunct professor at the Parsons School for Design, teaching a course called Creativity, Making a Living with Your Ideas, and is author of the book with the same name. In our discussion today, Jeffrey talked to me about why editing is the most important part of the creative process in any endeavor. It's where the magic happens, as he says. We talked about creating your own unique systems and processes that will lead to creating unique creations. And we talked about ensuring that your product or service ideas are actually providing a solution to a real problem. Without further ado then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Jeffrey Madov. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today from New York in the USA, Jeffrey Madov, who's the founder and CEO of Madov Productions. He's an adjunct professor at the Parsons School for Design and author of Creative Careers, Making a Living with Your Ideas. He's also an executive producer and playwright, and he's done so many other things in his life that it would take the whole podcast just to list them out. So we'll skip that part. Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, Jeffrey. It's a real privilege to have you as my guest.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Steve Sims, who was our guest on episode 243, and you were just mentioning that you spoke to him today, he was the one that suggested we have a conversation with you. So a big hello to Steve.
Hello to Steve. Great guy.
Now, as I kind of indicated in the intro, you've done so many different things in your life and there's been so many pivots in your life. So one of the things I'm really interested in is to learn about some of those pivot points and how they came about. I think that might be
quite topical given the situation we're in right now with the COVID-19 pandemic and various countries and locations being in forms of lockdown and that impacting businesses quite seriously. So tell us a little bit about some of the key pivots in your life and how they came about.
I guess a pivot is defined by you're going in one direction and you make a move into another direction, right? Hmm. And so probably the first big pivot was birth, you know, that opened up a whole new world to me from being inside of my mother to being in the outside world. And it seemed like an exciting and much bigger place. When I was in college, I'll jump ahead now to college in the interest of time so we don't spend the whole interview on my childhood. I finished college and I had graduated with a double major in psychology and philosophy. Tried to get a job as a sage, but the wisdom factories weren't hiring people. And I was working in a little clothing boutique. It was good, clearly a temporary situation in my life, but, you know, it was a job that paid the rent. And I got a call from a friend of mine, a guy that I grew up with, and we're still closest of friends to this day. And he said, you know, I've saved up some money. Can you think of a gig that would earn more than bank interest? And I said, well, I see what we sell in this store, and I could always draw. I'll start a clothing company. Mm. And he said, okay. And he sent me what was at the time more money than I had ever had, which was $1,500. And I started a clothing company. I had no idea what I was doing. I was ignorant, but not stupid. And the distinction is ignorant, you can learn, stupid's forever. Mm. And so I learned about the clothing business. And it was real trial by fire because I knew so little. And the business was doubling every 3 or 4 months. Mm-hmm. So I had to seek other financial backing, but I was growing a business. And within a year and a half, I had 110 employees. I had 2 factories, an office in New York, and I was living in Wisconsin still at that time, where I went to college. And it was a wild situation because I was learning as I was going, which is a great way to learn because the lessons really tend to embed when things are truly at stake, which they were. And I wanted to move to New York. And this is what preempted another, or actually presented another pivot. After spending time in New York every season, I would come to New York to show the clothes, to buy fabrics and so on. And I realized that after first intimidating me, New York actually attracted me. And I'm a stimulus junkie. Mm-hmm. I love New York City. I love the energy, everything about it. And so I negotiated a separation with my backer, who was a very good man. But the reason he backed me was because I provided employment for Wisconsin workers, and they banked at his bank. And he had been clear with me from the beginning that that's why he was backing me. I mean, he found me the business a novelty, but also because it would help his banking. And he took a chance on me, which I'll forever be appreciative of, but it was time to pivot again and move on. So I moved to New York, and that was a big deal because people said to me, well, do you have a job lined up? No. Do you have friends there? No. Do you have a place to live? No. Well, aren't you afraid of what's going to happen when you move there? And I said, no, I'm afraid of what would happen if I stayed here. Mm. You know, there was a whole life ahead of me. I was only like 24 years old. And so I wanted to experience and explore more. So I had saved up enough money. If I had was very frugal, which I was, I could travel the world, live basically out of a suitcase for a year, live a number of different places. And then when I ran out of money, I started another clothing company because I had a good reputation in that, built that up, sold it. And while I was selling it, I transitioned into filmmaking.
Mm.
And I did that by, you know, it's funny how serendipity happens. One of the people that I bought fabrics from, he said to me one day, "Do you know anything about the movie business?" And I said, "I go to movies, but I don't really know anything about the business." And he said, "Well, my son is your age and you've got a good head for business. He doesn't listen to me. Would you meet him?" I said, "Sure, I'd love to." I met his son, and he was involved in making a movie actually with Dennis Hopper, if you know who that was. And
Easy Rider fame.
That's right. That's right. And so I ended up sort of consulting on this film, also involved William Burroughs, if you know who that was. He wrote Naked Lunch, and he was one of the prime writers of the Beat Generation. Mm. And so this was an interesting combination of people. And I started learning about the film business. And during that time, I made a transition into starting a production company, having nothing to do with that film. And by the way, that film never happened, because that's a whole other story. But let's just say that there were excesses going along that would not net in making a movie.
Hmm.
These guys were lucky if they could get out of bed the next day, let alone make a movie the next day. But I learned and started a production company and loved doing that. I taught myself how to shoot, how to direct, how to edit, how to sound mix, how to light, how to do all of those things, built up that business and really enjoyed it and have been doing that for a long time. But then the opportunity also came along to teach. And that was at Parsons. And I had been a guest lecturer there. And I was able to devote a certain amount of time to the teaching, but I didn't give up the filmmaking. That was, you know, my full-time job that provided income. And but it's now years, many years later, and I'm also a adjunct professor and teaching a class that's the same name as my book, Creative Careers, Making a Living with Your Ideas. And then I was presented with another opportunity that I created for myself, which was meeting rock and roll legend Lloyd Price, who broke down the wall that was called Race Records in music back in 1952 with his first song, Laudy Miss Claudy. And I was totally taken by his story and said, "I can capture your voice. I want to tell your story." And so I started writing the story of his life as a musical play. And Lloyd loved what I was doing, ended up doing a what's called a 29-hour. We did that. I raised money. We did a full-up workshop. That went really well, raised further money, and now we are due to open in a regional theater, which is the usual path, next April of 21. And then the play opens for its commercial run mid-May to mid-June. So I just hope the world is in a healthier place and theater can be happening again. And during the time I was writing the play, there also came the opportunity to write a book. And the book was about my class. And I felt like there are such great ideas because the people and guests that I have come in and have so much knowledge and experience to share, yet nobody has a recipe for success. And by the way, I don't think there is such a thing as a recipe for success. And I thought I'd love to get these ideas out there and have a much greater reach than just the classroom, because I think there's a lot of people that could benefit from the wisdom and ideas that are presented in the book. And fortunately, found an agent and was able to sell the book. So then I had a book to write. And so what I'm doing now is out promoting the book and at the same time, keeping all my fingers going in the play and in my day-to-day business, which COVID has drawn to a screeching halt because there's no production at this point. So that's, you know, the like six different pivots that I've had in my life, all of them pretty significant for me in terms of taking me into new areas of creative expression.
Mm. Yeah. It's a fascinating story and so many different things that you've done. I'm curious, when you first started that fashion business, was that a natural progression? Had you had some experience through your family in running a business, or was it just a kind of a little spur of the moment decision?
Well, my parents, I grew up in Akron, Ohio. My parents had retail stores. So, you know, I would do work for them on the holidays, you know, when they were the busiest. So I would unpack things. I would reconcile what we received with what the orders were. And, you know, I learned certain aspects of the business And probably the most important thing I learned is you have to charge more than what you are charged for whatever it is you're selling, or you won't last in business. So my parents, mom and dad, were both entrepreneurs. And so I grew up in an entrepreneurial home. My sister, to this day, has her own retail store, which has been around now for 47 years and is quite successful, although certainly hit by COVID too. And so I did learn by osmosis some of those things, but I knew nothing about manufacturing. I knew nothing about what went into making clothes. I was so naive that when I saw fabric on the bolt in a store, I thought that was wholesale because it hadn't been made into anything yet.
Yeah.
You know, so, but I learned, and I learned a lot quickly. And so I did have some background, but not specific to what I was doing, but my background did help. And it did inform, actually everything I've done has informed the next thing that I do. And I think that's true with everybody, but they often don't notice that and they're not aware of it.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. We often take things for granted, that particularly thinking back to your journey, you know, there are things that you learn that are actually really valuable for the next step. And we sometimes take those for granted. And talk to me a little bit about the creative careers, how that came about, because I'm really fascinated by the concept of bringing people in and unpacking their stories and their journey, and then allowing students to question them as well. Because it's a little bit like learning from models in a particular area, you know, modeling masters of their craft.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I started off being a guest lecturer at Parsons, and I did that for about 4 years every semester. And the professor that brought me in told me there was an opportunity to teach. And he said, I think you should take it. And I said, I don't know, because of my work and my schedule. And he said, well, try it for a third of a semester. What I didn't realize is they were actually trying out three of us to see who they'd offer the position to. Well, I got offered the position. And they were flexible in terms of my time. So it's now 14 years later, and I'm still teaching the class. But what I learned, and this applies to your question, is I realized, for instance, that coming up with an idea for a line of clothing to design was the same thing as coming up with an idea for a commercial or a film I was going to make, which is starts with an idea. You write that idea down, you somehow illustrate it, whether it's a fashion sketch or a storyboard in the case of a film. You have to be able to communicate that idea to others so they can get on board to help you, because you can't do it alone. You have to cost out, what are the materials? What's the labor? How long is it going to take? Is there a market for what I'm doing? How much can I sell it for? And the whole cycle of business, the idea is, can I make enough to be able to do it again and again and again and again? So I found that creating a line of fashion was the same thing as creating a film, which is the same thing as writing a book, which is the same thing as just about anything you do. There is a protocol and a thought process that you have to go through. And I think there's a lot of illusory divisions between businesses that when you think about it, there are many more similarities than there are businesses, regardless of what the pursuit is that you're doing.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great way to look at it, kind of chunk it up to the higher principles that sit behind everything. And And I guess that talks a little bit to creativity. How do you define creativity?
Good question. And I define creativity as the compelling need to affect change.
Hmm.
And so I think that that also makes it very wide open. Most people think of creativity, you know, oh, is that a writer or a painter or something like that? But, you know, you can be a dentist. And if you came up with some new way that is cheaper, faster, and painless to do teeth whitening, that's creative. Mm. Entrepreneurs, by their nature, are making something from nothing. They're starting a business, whatever that business is, and they're starting something and they're making something where nothing existed. And so that's creative. So I think that people tend to put themselves into two silos. Well, I'm creative. I don't care about business. I don't understand business. Or I'm a business person. I don't know about creativity, yeah, but I know business. And there are so many examples of people that are both. And I think that that's really important to understand, not to say no to yourself, but to allow yourself to pursue what it is that drives you and give it a try. And, you know, I think the chunking it to those principles, as you said, is absolutely right. What does it really take to do X? And how different is it from what I have done before? And in most cases, almost all cases, you're going to find, well, it's actually pretty much the same. Mm. And, you know, maybe different vocabulary. Sometimes there's a different skill set that's involved, but the principles are always the same.
Yeah. And also, I mean, as you were telling your story earlier, I thought there's crossovers as well, because I know when you first went into the filmmaking business, a large part of your business was actually doing filming commercials for the fashion industry. So there was kind of natural crossover there, wasn't there, from what you'd already learned and where you'd already been successful into the new area that you were passionate about.
You're absolutely right. And what I realized, there were a couple of things that I knew because I had been in the business.
Hmm.
Number one is there were fashion shows, and the designer always was backstage during the fashion shows. So they never saw their own shows. And then they would rely on their employees, they're usually head of sales, to say, well, how did the crowd receive it? You know, how did that look on the runway and all that? And because they were backstage. And I thought, why are people recording these shows? Video existed at that point already. But nobody was videoing fashion shows. I was one of the first people doing that. And I thought, so here's an opportunity that solves a problem. The problem is the designer doesn't get to see how their clothes are received in the moment. They have to rely on secondhand interpretation, mostly from people who would be afraid to lose their job if they told the truth. Yeah. So, but then I thought, and there's a value beyond that. When people are waiting to go in and see the newest line, why not be playing that video on a screen in their lobby area? And why not be playing that video at point of purchase in stores? So when you went to the designer boutique, you saw their fashion show, which at that time, the public had no access to see fashion shows. Mm. So that allowed me to also do a sales pitch on how this could amortize costs. You can use it for buyers early in the season. Once you've shipped the goods, you can ship it to stores and they can play it, and it will be like a magnet that will draw people over. Because remember, at that time, people weren't videoing their shows. So you had a novel display, which was the video, which is now, of course, ubiquitous. So I looked at the business applications, what practically this offered, what problems it solved, how to amortize the costs. And I could talk to designers because I know the business. And, you know, so they were comfortable with me. And so when I would interview them, I knew the language because I had been through it. So you're absolutely right. That was a crossover that I could immediately implement to start building a client base.
Hmm. And again, sort of drilling or chunking that up to the principles, it was like you discovered one problem, which was the designer not actually having the ability to firsthand see how his show was being received and how it went down, and then opportunities beyond that, which were the presenting it to buyers, presenting the fashion show to buyers that hadn't been at the show itself, presenting the show to the public in the stores later on when the lines were available to buy. And then the creative part was the bringing about the transformation for those customers.
Right. That's right. So, you know, it's kind of how my grandmother approached cooking a chicken, you know? So for dinner, you'd have chicken dinner. And then for the next week, you would have chicken soup, chicken salad, you know? Yeah. And she would, before the term became popular, repurpose the chicken, you know, into a multitude of nutritious ways. So what I wanted to do is have this video banquet, if you will, that you could feast on in different ways and amortize the costs so that, because it was a new investment, nobody was doing it. So I had to convince them it was worth their money, because it's not just this use, it's that use and that use and that use. And that became a very compelling sell. And, you know, so I think that, you know, that's part of what you have to do, especially if you're innovating, is you have to give people a reason to buy what you're selling. And you also have to be clear that what you are selling, there's a market for. So you can fall in love with your own idea, but if nobody else thinks it's a good idea, it's going to fail. You know, so you have to have that proof of concept. And so my very first client, who was probably the most significant American designer at that time, Halston, he immediately got it. He immediately saw the value of it. And then shortly thereafter, I got Ralph Lauren as a client because he saw the value of it. And I kept Halston as a client till he stopped designing and unfortunately passed away. And I worked with Ralph Lauren for 36 years. So, you know, but they saw the application. And that's really important. It's really important when you're trying to innovate is to, first of all, make sure that there are people beyond you that think it's a good idea. And more importantly, that they're willing to pay for it.
Yeah.
Because people can blow up a lot of smoke, right? Oh, that's a great idea. That's great. Oh, you want to buy it? It's not right for us, but a great idea.
So what was your process from recognizing that as an opportunity, recognizing the idea, understanding the benefits that it might provide directly, and then the secondary benefits like the repurposed thoughts, going from there to having the conversations with those designers and then selling it? What was your process, and how much investment did you put into it at the time you were selling it versus afterwards when you knew that you could sell?
Well, so in my particular case, there's a lot to unpack there. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. First of all, having been through what I went through, which was a good experience, but having a financial backer, that there were certain limitations, which are totally understandable. This is, by the way, all individual preference. I am not suggesting this is right for everybody. It was right for me. And what was right for me was that I didn't want to be beholden to anybody. So that meant that I had to bootstrap my business. So I bought things as I could afford things. I kept my overhead low initially because I wanted to buy equipment. You know, I wanted to own. So for instance, you know, if I was going in to do an edit room, a professional edit room was several hundred dollars an hour. But editing's where the magic happens in all art. And we can revisit that statement a bit later because I think it's really important. But The thing about that is that because the cost of editing was quite expensive, I couldn't really afford to experiment. I had to go in there with a very clear map of where I was going with that project and get it done, because if I went over a few hours, bam, my profits were gone. So, you know, so the first thing I wanted to buy was my own editing system so I could experiment and spend more time creating unique things. So, not wanting to have financial backing and to seek that because I didn't want any encumbrances on me, you know, that also can prevent a certain exponential growth, which you need to get financing to do. But I think that you have to ask yourself a fundamental question, which is, what's success look like to you? You know, I know lots of people that are really wealthy and miserable. Mm. And, you know, so can you consider yourself wealthy? I mean, can you consider yourself successful if you're not happy with what you're doing or with what your life is? For my value system, the answer is no. Yeah. So I always, you know, wanted to do things more independently so that I didn't have to get into dealing with shareholders or any of that. I know how to speak the language. I have created videos that have sold companies for hundreds of millions of dollars, but did I want to be that person? No. You know, and I think I learned for myself some very valuable lessons very young. And, you know, what was most important to me is enjoying the process of what I do. Mm. And that engagement in the process was more important to me than making a lot of money. I've done okay. You know, I live in New York City. I have two kids I put through school. I have a wife. But, you know, I know that I've made decisions that have would hamstring a certain degree of that, but I didn't care. I mean, like teaching, it's not like that pays a lot, but it's a very fulfilling thing to do. And I love doing it. And it opened up the door to do a book. And if I hadn't done the book, I wouldn't have met you. And look how things
happen. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really important point. And it's probably one that can't be emphasized enough.
You mean meeting you?
Yeah, that one too. Yeah, I think, you know, defining what success means for you and the importance of happiness in that. And I have spoken to a number of guests that have had, I guess, measured by the amount of money they've made and the kind of awards that they've gotten in their particular field, in their business, and the size of the business and the growth of the business, measured by those things, have been hugely successful, and yet and have set themselves goals based on all that. And when they've achieved those goals, they feel very empty. And, you know, fortunately, most of the ones I've spoken to have kind of realized that and learned from that and have made a big pivot at that point that says, you know, focus on being happy, and then, you know, did a check on their values. So sometimes it's been, you know, well, maybe I need to contribute more, or sometimes it's been, maybe I need to give back, or usually it's along those themes. Mm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the teaching I see is probably fitting in a lot more into that category.
Yeah, and it does, but it's also, I have fun with it. You know, I'm not so altruistic that I would be doing it if I didn't get enjoyment from it. You know, yes, I love bringing the students, you know, my hope is to inspire and entertain and educate and inform. And I love doing that. And so I think that you have to find what moves you. Because if you're doing things that you really love, as the old saying goes, then it's not work anymore.
That's right. Yeah.
Having said that, however, you know, having said that, it's also there's the realities of life. You know, you got to pay for home and food and other things. And so, you know, you got to do that stuff too. And it's easier to make these grand statements when you're in a position to do that, as opposed to those who may not be for economic reasons and so forth, and through no fault of their own.
Yeah.
So I'm acutely aware of that too.
That's right. Yeah. And particularly in our current situation where lots of people have been denied the opportunity of continuing the work that they had because of,
that's right.
You know, lockdowns and the impact of the COVID virus. So, yeah.
But, you know, I'll say one thing about that, which I think is, it's interesting. As part of, you know, seeding the ground for my book, I was asked by the marketing department of my publisher, said, do you think you could write something that would speak to the idea of creativity in our current environment with COVID? And I said, yeah, I could. So that was a quick answer. I said, well, when you think about it, great works of art, be it film or a book or a painting or a poem or whatever it is, those things are usually the result of trauma. Being it societal, like what we're going through now, where people are just frightened and don't know what's going to be happening, or personal trauma, whether it's a relationship that breaks up, a death, you know, it can be anything that shakes the foundations of your being. If you can channel that energy and realize that you shouldn't fear that energy, that that fear can fuel your creativity, because that's where the great stuff comes from. And to use a hackneyed term, authenticity, when you can authentically allow your emotions to take over and propel your creative impulses in whatever direction that is. It could be a career pivot. It doesn't have to be a painting. But the point is, how do you use something like this to eventually make your life better? And so I think that it's important to realize it's terrible times that oftentimes bring about the greatest and most innovative work.
Mm. Yeah, and the other side of that coin also is that where people have those fears and have experienced that trauma or are experiencing that trauma, to have some outlet where they can be in some ways distracted, but at the same time channel those feelings into some creative pursuit, that's a very healing thing as well, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, now you mentioned editing is where the magic happens in all art. And I remember you said in the book, was it Rodin, the sculptor, who you attributed?
Rodin.
Rodin, attributed something similar to that. So explain that to us a little bit more, because I think that was fascinating how you kind of explained that in the book.
So I always loved this statement by the sculptor Auguste Rodin. And someone said to him, and I'm paraphrasing here, how do you take a 2-ton block of marble and make it into a woman? And he says, I chip away everything that doesn't look like a woman. And I love that idea, because that's what great art is. And that is the economy, efficiency, and velocity of editing. So if you're taking a picture, it's not only what's in the frame, it's also what you left out of the frame to focus the viewer's attention on. If you're doing a painting, you know, it's the same thing. If you're writing a book or a play, it happens in the editing, you know, so you get the story out and that's kind of the beginning. And then you come back to it and refine it and refine it and refine it. So, for instance, in my play, when we did the first what's called table read, I'm working with my director, who's a tremendously talented person. And there's this scene that happens in Australia. where Lloyd gets Lloyd Price, the main character, gets high for the first time in his life. So I wrote this scene, and the table read is literally you have all 19 actors around a table. So we're hearing the actors' voices for the first time, and it's just a cold read. They're reading right out of the script. And so as they're reading this scene, they're cracking up. They're laughing. And, you know, I wrote it. That's what I was hoping would happen, right? But something was not sitting right with me. So when we finished and we took a break, I said to Sheldon Epps, the director, wow, what do you think of that Australia scene? And he said, well, we know it's funny. People laughed. It's entertaining. But is it essential? Mm. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, does it either reveal more about the character or move the plot forward? And I said, no. Mm. He said, then it's not essential. We don't need it. And bam, there went 6.5 pages of script. And so, which made it better. It made the script better. So first of all, you can't allow anything to be too precious to you. Mm. You can't fall in love with your own stuff. You have to be ruthless when you edit and only put in there, you know, you chip away everything that doesn't look like a woman. You get rid of everything that's not essential. You know, and the more you do that, the greater you refine that, the better the work that you do will be. And it's that kind of focus. So that's why I say that that's true, not only in art, it's also, you know, true in business. Yeah. That, you know, you've got to focus on what it is and be ruthless about it in that sense. So it's, you know, I tell that story because to me that really sums it up. And, you know, here I am as the writer hearing all the actors cracking up. And as that's happening at first, I think, I'm funny, you know, but realizing in fact that, I didn't need it. And you cut it out and, you know, and then you move on, by the way. You have to know also when to let go, because again, that's what makes the work better.
Yeah, yeah, and an important part of that is keeping the bigger picture in mind, right? So you want to produce a fabulous play, not a funny scene, and so
exactly right, exactly right. Yeah, I mean that you just said it. That's it. You know, it's create a wonderful play. Not a wonderful scene. Yeah. No, you're exactly right.
And so even though there's a wonderful scene there, if it's not contributing to that wonderful play or fabulous play, then leave it out. You can always use it for something else. Yeah. Repurpose, right?
That's right. Right. Go back to the chicken metaphor. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Bloopers reel or whatever else. All right. I wanted to come back to your creative careers book and how that came about, and also the teaching that you do, which underpins that, because I love the whole idea. I mean, you mentioned that you have a lot of fun, and I'm guessing you probably learn a lot out of having those conversations with the people you have as guests, because when I started reading the book Creative Careers and the background of it, how that came about, I thought it's a little bit like my podcast, because I have a lot of fun talking to wonderful people like you and I learn a lot, then I get to share it with my audience. Now you're doing something like that in real time with a real audience. So tell us a little bit more about how you construct those conversations with people that in a way that, you know, draws out their knowledge and their processes and also enables the students to get the most from them and interact with them.
Well, like you, who has read my book, so you can comment on it and reference it, my guess, I familiarize myself with their work. So it might be a cognitive neuroscientist. It might be the architect who designed the 9/11 memorial, or a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist or a painter, whatever. I familiarize myself with their work and educate myself about them so that I am honoring them by doing a good interview with them because they're giving me their time. So I want to make sure that they consider that time well spent, you know, and so I do that. And so I do a lot of research. I think that the best interview, I don't even like the term interview. To me, it's a conversation and I'm the proxy for the audience. If I'm engaged and interested, my audience is going to be engaged and interested. And if I'm not and somehow just checking off a bunch of questions, that's not going to be interesting to my guest. It's not going to be interesting to the students. And I'm always prepared. I look at it as kind of like a jazz improv. We've always got the medley that we can go into. But if my guest starts going off on a riff and it's really interesting and fascinating, it had nothing to do with what we were talking about, but it's so interesting and fascinating, then we'll go off on the riff. And then I can always reel it back into our melody, if you will, after they've done their solo, you know? So, and I fortunately, because I'm in the production business, I fortunately had the foresight to video all my classes. I had been told for a long time, had been suggested, wow, you ought to do a book about your class. And I said, okay, good idea. But I never really knew how to go about doing that. And then I happened to be at a dinner party, seated next to this woman who was very nice. And we were talking, oh, what's a class? And I told her, and she said, that would be great. I'd like to introduce you to somebody here. My boss is here, and she's an agent for nonfiction. Would you like to meet her? Because your book sounds, your class sounds fascinating. It would make a great book. So sure, happy to meet her. So the first thing that person says to me isn't hello. After it's Jeff Madoff and he has this class, I think it'd make a great book. Her response was, well, how big's your social media following? And I said, it's not significant at all. Well, then I'm not interested. I said, well, do you care what the book is about? And she said, not really, no. If you don't have at least 100,000 active followers and a publisher thinks that maybe you can sell to 5% of them, 5,000 books justifies a printing. But if we can't do that, they're not interested. So no, I'm not interested. I said, nice meeting you. And yeah, went off for the rest of the evening. Literally 2 nights later, I'm at a friend's book launch. And it's at this bar and restaurant. And I'm talking to this woman, wonderful person. And her name is Jody Lipper. And Jody said to me, oh, your class sounds really interesting. I'd love to come observe it. Could I? And I said, sure. And then she said, have you thought of doing a book? And I told her that story. And she said, well, let me come to your class, but I'd like to introduce you to my agent. She came to the class. She really liked it. She was kind and generous enough to introduce me to her agent. We had a 45-minute conversation in person where it was what you would hope as an author would be the conversation, which is what's the book about? Who would want to read it? Why would they want to read it? And all that kind of thing. And so 45 minutes into it, I said to her, Brandy, who was the agent, you know, you haven't asked me once about my social media following. And she laughed and said, well, because I don't care. You know, I want to know if this is going to be a good book. And then I told her about the other night and she said, if you get a few of your people that you've interviewed to post something about your book, that's a big enough megaphone to market. So I'm not concerned about yours. You've interviewed all these high profile people. If just a few of them will do something, that's going to benefit you. And so she was able to sell the book. And an interesting addendum to this is first publisher that wanted to meet with us, which was one of the major business book publishers. Their response was, well, why would business people care about creatives? The next was, you know, if you talk about psychology and creativity, that's in the realm of self-help in terms of the book selling market. They said to me, well, why would a creative want to know anything about business? So the third publisher that we met with said, when we walked in, greeted me and said, love the idea of your book. You know, creativity goes hand in glove with each other. And most people don't recognize that. And before the meeting ended, they said, how soon do you think you could write this? Mm-hmm. And so my agent said, I think we've got a sale. And we did. So fortunately, they recognized.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not just writing the proposal for a book. And writing a proposal, by the way, is totally different than writing the book. And Jody wrote the proposal. I hired her to do it because it's a marketing document. It has nothing to do with the actual book, little to do with the actual book. And then there's the selling of the book. They actually have to write the book. And then after you write the book, you know, then you got to promote the book. Mm. So it's a whole process. And I think a lot of people don't understand that. So I'm learning as I go. But I just also wanted to highlight what you said earlier is so true. When you mentioned me learning along with the students, teaching is a fabulous way to learn. And, you know, you're doing it without a classroom, but you're doing the same thing when you talk to people that you find interesting and you ask them questions that you find interesting. Mm-hmm. You're learning and you're sharing what you learn with your audience. And that's teaching. And so, yeah, I love that.
Yeah. What I love about the book story, too, is, you know, you in the process you outline, I mean, leaving aside the publisher that was more interested in the vanity metrics, as I like to call them, the idea of you basically sold it first before you produced the book itself.
Yes. Yeah, that's a really interesting point because what would be the point of writing it if you couldn't sell it? And what you need to sell it isn't the book itself because they won't read it. You know, you've got to give them that selling document, which is the proposal. Mm.
Mm, that's right. Yeah. If you think of the publisher's side of it, if they had to read all the books that they published and sold, they never get anything done, would they?
That's right. That's right. So that's a really important point. I actually had that conversation with a friend of mine a couple of weeks ago, and he said, you know, God, it's so daunting just to write the book. And I said, you're writing a whole book? Well, yeah, isn't that what you have to do? And I said, no. No, you don't want to do that because it's going to change and they aren't going to read it. So, you know, that's what a proposal is for. A proposal might be 35 pages. The book might be 300 pages. So, you know, you have to be able to deliver on what the proposal promises, but there's no point in writing the whole book.
Yeah. Now, it comes back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of understanding that there is a need for your idea, that there's a market That's for right. your idea, that somebody's going to be paying, will pay for that idea. So,
I mean, that's what they call in business proof of concept, right? That somebody will actually buy it. You know, that gives you proof of concept. And if they die, and by the way, that doesn't mean that you aren't going to get a lot of rejections along the way. I was fortunate that I didn't. That it was, I think, I don't know what number it was, but didn't go through a whole lot of rejections. I think they also felt there was a limited, well, this lighting is doing weird stuff. You know, they didn't know whether there would be a market or not. And so the publisher really targeted who they went to because that was going to give them the true indication of whether or not there was a market for this book. Fortunately, there was.
Yeah. So it's to me, that says understand who the ideal reader in this case might be and approach the publishers that actually publish for that reader.
That's right. Yeah. And you know, this book has a pretty wide berth because if you're graduating from college and you're embarking on a career, this book is great for you. If you are thinking of starting your own business, this book is great for you. If you're looking to do a career pivot, this book can be inspiring for you. So there isn't a particular market. You know, there are different applications for it. But I think that the lessons learned in this, my hope and the feedback I'm getting is that they're of a fairly wide use to a wide range of people. So, you know, hopefully that's the case.
Yeah. And
seems to be.
And also what strikes me about the book is there's, as you said, there's a lot of high profile people, very successful people that you've had in your classroom that you highlight in the book. And to me, it's just one way to, I mean, you know, you think of some of those people and you think, oh, it's fascinating. I wonder how they got to where they were and what were some of the drivers and what were some of the things that, you know, they faced, the hurdles that they faced, and how did they overcome those? And there's a lot in the book that addresses those kind of questions and what you can learn from them, what you can take out of those stories and apply perhaps in your own life.
Well, that's right. And I think that one of the things that's really important is oftentimes people just want to project this highly glossy, positive image of what they're doing. And, you know, if they're an entrepreneur, it's like they've got this hockey stick graph of their business that has just taken off and, you know, I'm bringing value and that's, you know, all of that. There is no entrepreneur that I have ever met, ever, who hasn't taken some real gut punches along the way. That's just the nature of the business, the nature of owning your own business. And so things may start off faster than you thought, like my clothing company, but along the way, you get some real gut punches, you know, and most people don't want to talk about that. And I think it would be helpful. And in fact, I think it's misleading when people don't talk about some of the struggle. Because then those people who are trying to learn from you are thinking, is there something the matter with me? This isn't easy. This is really hard. And I believe that you give people real information.
Hmm. That's wonderful. All right, Jeffrey, this is fabulous. I think we might pivot back to the melody, to use your analogy. And I think it's a good time to go to the buzz, which is our innovation round. And it's a series of five questions that I have that I ask every guest. And it's designed to help our audience, who are primarily leaders, innovators, creators in their field, with some tips from your experience. So I've got those five questions. Hopefully you'll inspire the audience to do something awesome today as a result.
Well, at least it's coming at the end, so I won't inspire them to turn this off. Hopefully they've listened to it.
I doubt it. What's the number one thing you think anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
To constantly be curious and to constantly expose themselves to new ideas, new people, read books, go to theater, take walks, talk to somebody you never talked to before, and just constantly be curious, keep learning. And one of the things, by the way, that I do in my class the first day is I write on the blackboard the word wonder and ask the students to define that. And then I change the O to an A and it's wander. Yeah. And I think you have to wander to wonder. And so I think that's the most important thing is always be curious, always be learning.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, and I like the idea, the wander to wander analogy. I had quite a few episodes ago now, I had a neuroscientist, Fiona Kerr, on the episode, and she talked about the importance of allowing your brain to wander, in a sense, in terms of daydreaming, and important that was to bring in new ideas. So. Very similar line. Okay, now what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
Take that advice. Really, it's about being aware of what's going on in the marketplace I'm trying to serve, and what are the innovations that are going on, and just, again, constantly exposing and taking that advice, which is stay on top of things and stay aware and stay curious.
Yeah. And your pivot into filmmaking was probably a good example of that, where you observed the director or the producer of, or the designer, is the right word I'm looking for, the designer being backstage and not seeing his own show. And you saw that there was a disconnect there in terms of what information he was getting and potentially with what the show was actually, the reception to the show was actually being. So you then explored ways to address that.
Mm. Right. That's right. You know, one of the questions is, aside from, am I the only one in love with this idea, is this providing a solution to an actual problem? Mm. You know, am I saving people time? Am I saving them money? Am I somehow enhancing or adding value to their lives?
Yeah. Yeah. That's really good. I like that. Is it a real problem, and am I adding value to it, or creating I like to call it a bridge from before the problem to after the problem.
Right.
Okay. Now, do you have a favorite resource that you use most often?
Yes, I do. My brain. and I think we should all use our brains and keep them well nourished by physically taking care of yourself, emotionally taking care of yourself, and constantly filling it with new fuel. And that fuel are the ideas that we're talking about. The other thing that, you know, I can mention something also tied into that, which is productivity. You know, everybody's looking for productivity hacks. Mm. And I don't want to jump off course with your question. So I'm sorry, ask me the question and then I'll answer that.
Well, the next question is, what's the best way to keep a project on track? So maybe it fits in there.
Well, I think it's to always have a pencil and paper and calendar with you. That can all be the same journal. Mm-hmm. So that there is cognitive neuroscience behind actually writing things down. You're going to remember them more than typing them into your phone or on a computer. And it's the muscle-brain relationship. So you are going to remember things much better if you write them down. If you have a calendar and you are diligent about keeping your scheduling going, you'll know when not to overbook yourself and, you know, all of that. So I think that the tools are really simple, but like all tools, it's how do you use them? So for me, having a notebook, a calendar, and a pen is a great way to stay focused, stay on track, and to be productive.
Mm. Yeah, it's wonderful. And I love the idea. I'm playing a lot with sketchnoting at the moment. I'm probably the world's worst drawer, but I'm trying to learn how to sketchnote things out, because I admire people that go into these TED Talks, for example, and they get up and they do a one-page sketch that represents the whole talk. And mm-hmm. I figure that's another way to build that connection, you know, the memory brain muscle connection.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Now, what's the number one thing you think anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
Be themselves. Be who you are, because nobody else is you. So get in touch with who you are. And get in touch with whatever unique offerings that you have and be true to that. Because nobody's going to be you better than you can.
Yeah, I think that was Dr. Seuss, wasn't it? Nobody's youer than you.
Could have been, I don't know, but it certainly could have been.
All right. So the self-awareness is a really critical part of that then, isn't it?
Understanding, yes, absolutely.
Drives you and then leaning into that.
Absolutely, yes. And only you can answer that. So I think it's always that self-awareness, I think, is directly coupled to always asking yourself questions, always questioning.
Being curious. And it's interesting, in your book, you've got kind of, you wrap up each chapter with a series of questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what it is, because I'm wanting, while hopefully they've gotten something out of that particular chapter and what examples were given and stories that were told, and I think the stories is how we learn. I think that it's really important to then not let go of those thoughts, reinforce those thoughts by asking those questions at the end of each chapter. So at the end, you could have a rather full journal of things that struck you, that resonated with you, and all of that by the time you finish reading the book.
Mm. Yep. I've already got several pages after having gone into the first few chapters in great detail now. Okay. Well, thanks, Jeffrey. This has been absolutely fabulous. Now, where can people find out more about you and get a copy of the book, Creative Careers, and maybe even get in touch? Thanks for what you've shared with us today.
In terms of getting the book, you can buy it at all fine booksellers. Mm. It's available. It's Creative Careers, Making a Living with Your Ideas by B. Jeffrey Madoff. And the B stands for book. Not really. But it is B. Jeffrey Madoff. And it's available at all fine booksellers. And even some not so fine booksellers, probably. But it's available everywhere. I would also ask the additional favor is that if you like the book, if it resonates with you, please post a review, because that helps. That truly helps. On Instagram, you can go to @acreativecareer, and you can see short quotes from my guests in class that are pretty cool, because I have good guests and they say really good things. And you can go to the website, which is www.acreativecareer.com, which has longer form interviews. And I started a group, a Creative Careers group on LinkedIn, where there's longer, not only longer quotes, but also my hope is to create a real idea exchange hub where people can pose questions, be involved in discussion, and really have a robust exchange of ideas, which I would really do that, love to do that. And then finally, there is Madoff Productions, madoff productions.com. And you can see the kind of film work and video work that I do.
Mm. All right. Well, thanks for all of that. We'll post links in the show notes so people can click straight through.
Great. Thank
you. Do you have some parting advice you'd like to leave our listener with today?
I think that the main advice that I can give is always be curious, always be questioning, always be searching. And, you know, it's no fun to be around people who aren't curious, because that means that they think they know everything. Yeah. And so I love learning. And so I think be a lifelong learner, and it's going to make you a more interesting person.
Mm. Yeah, that certainly resonates with me, and I would definitely support that. So thanks for that. Now, finally then, Jeffrey, who would you like me to chat with on a future Innova Buzz podcast, and why?
Do they have to be living? I don't know. I've heard such great things about you, Jürgen. You could probably... you know, I can certainly suggest some wonderful people to you that I think would add a lot to your viewers. Now, not knowing who all you have, but I mean, how many episodes have you done?
I think this is 320.
Wow. You know, because there's a lot of really good people out there. And, you know, sharing ideas in the way that you're doing it, which I think is great. You know, I can recommend some people to you right off the top of my head. Do you know who Michael Roderick is?
Yes, we do. We've got Michael scheduled in.
Oh, that's, yeah, I think I put you two together via email, as a matter of
yeah,
fact.
I'll be, yeah.
Yeah, he's a great guy, a terrific connector, and is really good at helping people build effective networks and what to do. John Levy is a cognitive neuroscientist who has not only an amazing network of people, really interesting insights into how people behave. And he is terrific. Are you familiar with Dory Clark?
Yes, yes. Dory was actually, it's time we had Dory back, because she was one of my very early guests.
Yeah, Dory's great. You know, we're good friends. She's a very supportive, very generous person, great speaker, and, you know, has a lot that is interesting, really interesting to say. So how's that?
Yeah, that's a great start. Yeah. So we've got Michael already scheduled, so we'll give you a shout out and give him a shout out today. Give you a shout out on his episode. We'll get in touch with John and we'll invite Dory back as well.
And do you know Joe Polish?
No, I know of him, but I don't know him personally.
He'd be great. And I'd be happy to make that introduction too.
Great. Well, that's wonderful. That's four for the price of one. Thanks, Jeffrey. And thanks so much for sharing your time and your insights with us so generously today. I've really enjoyed this. I've learned a lot. I've had a lot of fun. And I love the book Creative Careers and how it came about. I love how you kind of took your teaching gig, turned it into those meaningful conversations with people that have experienced a lot in their life, and then turned that into a book. So thanks for doing all of that. I really encourage people to check out the book, get a copy, read it. It's actually fabulous. There's lots to learn from it. So thanks for all of that, Jeffrey, and I wish you all the best for the future, and let's stay in touch.
Thank you. I would love to, and thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation. You're a terrific interviewer. It was a lot of fun. Thanks a lot.
Well, thanks, Jeffrey.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that engaging, insightful, and informative conversation with Jeffrey and took something away from his episode. I love his entire philosophy around the creative process and how it can be applied to all of business. I really like his approach to build his creativity course from meaningful conversations with successful people too. I'd love to know what you took away from Jeffrey's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which you can find at innovabiz.co/ Jeffrey Madoff. That is JeffreyMadoff, all lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/ Jeffrey Madoff. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Jeffrey there, as well as links to the Madoff Productions and the Creative Careers websites, his social media pages, the Creative Careers group on LinkedIn, and the other resources we spoke about in today's conversation. Jeffrey suggested that we have a conversation with Michael Roderick of Small Pond Enterprises, author and marketing consultant Dory Clark, who's been on before, behavioural scientist and author John Levy, and Joe Polish, one of the most sought-after marketers today, on future InnovaBuzz podcast episodes. So four for the price of one. Excellent. We have already scheduled Michael. And Dory, John, and Joe, keep an eye on your inboxes for an invitation that's coming from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Jeffrey Madoff. Tune in again to the next episodes of the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we've got more fantastic guests lined up, including mindset coach Linda M. Perry and founder of the Australian organic food company, Adrian Sester. Thanks for listening to this episode. Make sure you subscribe to the show to be reminded of new episodes. It's free to subscribe. Leave a review if you like. Even if you don't like me, I'm okay with that. I'm asking you to leave a review because it helps other people find this show. Go to innovabiz.co to join our marketing transformation community and access a free gift my team and I made for you. It's the Marketing Master Mini Class. We want to give you everything you need to transform your marketing into a human-centered, relationship-focused growth engine. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.